When she finished, he made her do it again. She went back to work, but this time it was taking too long for Tommy, and he started to get pissed. He started chewing her out for not doing a good job, telling her she didn't know what the fuck she was doing. Eventually, she got it right, considerately swallowing so as not to contaminate the pool with Tommy's unborn children. 5 minutes later, Tommy put her to work again. I think a lot of RTB's friends gained a newfound respect for Tommy that night. Not only was he built like a skyscraper, not only did he have a never-ending orgasm, but when he was done, he shared. He looked up at the ring of guys around the jacuzzi, staring in shock and amazement, and ordered Honey to work her way around the tub, blowing everyone. It was hard to get that image out of my mind when I sat around the dinner table with the happy couple and Tommy's parents in West Covina a few months later. She just didn't seem like the kind of girl you'd want to take home to your mother unless you were raised at the Bunny Ranch. I passed on Tommy's offer, not out of respect for him, but because I was too fucked up to get turned on. In fact, I decided that I wanted to leave the party altogether. I was drug sick, confused, and wanted to see Lita. The problem was that RTB had the doors locked and blocked, like usual, to make sure no one left too fucked up to drive. To make matters worse, I had no idea where I'd put my clothes. I ran to the wall and scaled it completely naked. As I dropped down on the other side, I noticed that the stones had cut up my chest and legs, which were trickling blood. Outside, two girls who couldn't get into the party were waiting in a 68 Mustang. "Nikki!" they yelled. Fortunately, I always left my keys in my car then. I still do. So I hopped into my Porsche and gassed it down the hill. The Mustang screeched on the gravel and took off after me. I floored it to 90, looked back to see if I had lost them, and as I did so, was suddenly thrown against the dashboard. I had crashed into a telephone pole. It was sitting next to me in the car in a decimated passenger seat. If anyone had been sitting there, their head would have been smashed flat. I stepped out of the car in shock and stood in front of the steaming mess that was once my true love. It was totaled, useless. The girls who were chasing me were gone, probably more scared than I was. And I was alone, naked, bloody, and dazed. I tried to raise my arm to hitch a ride, but a sharp pain raced from my elbow to my shoulder. I walked to Coldwater Canyon, where an older couple picked me up, and without saying a word about the fact that I was butt naked, drove me to the hospital. The doctors put my shoulder in a sling, it was dislocated, and sent me home with a bottle of pain pills. I spent the next 3 days unconscious, whacked out, on painkillers. Except for Lita, no one knew where I was. All that the band knew was that my Porsche was lying totaled halfway down the hill, and I was nowhere to be found. To this day, I still wonder how much I was missed. No one ever bothered to call the house to see if I was all right. The only good thing that came out of the experience was that I developed a lifelong love for Percodan. The car crash, combined with everything else creepy and dangerous that had happened to us, brought me back to reality, and Lita talked me into backing off my flirtation with Satanism. Instead, heroin began to consume me, first to kill the pain of the shoulder, then later to kill the pain of life, which is the pain of not being on heroin. Vince had found a girl who could hook us up. He'd bring in a brown lump of tar, a sheet of tin foil, and some kind of homemade funnel made out of cardboard and tape. We'd take a pinch of the heroin, put it on the foil, hold a lighter underneath, and suck up the smoke as we chased the burning ball down the foil. We'd get so fucking stoned, we'd just sit on the couch and stare at each other. Pretty soon, we were getting higher-grade heroin through a bassist who played in a local punk band and was good friends with Robin Crosby of Rat. Once the two of them taught us how to use needles, it was all over. The first times I shot up, I just passed out. When I came to, everyone would be laughing at me because I'd have been lying in the middle of the floor for 15 minutes. Vince's vice was women, and with those first shots, I learned that mine was to be drugs for the rest of my life. I invented speedballs without anyone even having to tell me about them. One afternoon, I wondered whether shooting up coke with the heroin would keep me from passing out. So I did my first speedball, and I didn't pass out. I did, however, spend the 15 minutes usually consigned to blacking out on the floor of the bathroom, vomiting all over the toilet and floor. But I didn't mind throwing up. I was always good at that. Luckily, with one arm in a cast, I couldn't shoot up on my own. It kept me in check. I couldn't play bass either, but that was fine with our producer, Tom Werman, because he was constantly calling Elektra complaining that I couldn't play and Vince couldn't sing. So I would come to the studio with my arm in a sling and hang out and get high and look after things. Werman had told me throughout the session, "Whatever you do, don't look at my production notes. I have things there that I'm thinking about as far as the direction of the music is concerned, and I don't want you freaking out over them." Of course, that was the worst thing he could have told us. From then on, we kept trying to find out what he was writing. But whenever he left the studio, he'd take them with him. One evening, when he stepped out to go to the bathroom, he left the notes behind. I ran to the mixing desk, excited to finally find out what was really on his mind. I opened the book and peered at the words, "Don't forget to mow the lawn on Sunday. Remember to get ballet slippers for school play. Buy new pitching wedge." I seethed with anger. I could not believe that this person who called himself our producer could be thinking about anything other than Motley Crue and rock and roll. I walked outside to find him, but the receptionist stopped me. Alice Cooper was working in the studio, and I had been begging her for days to let me meet him. He seemed bigger than God, and this was my lucky Sunday. "He's ready to meet you," she said. "He said to wait for him in the room outside his studio at 3. Standing outside his studio at 3 was an impeccably dressed man in a suit holding a briefcase. "Alice will be out in a second," he told me, as if I was about to meet the Godfather. A minute later, the door to the studio opened and smoke billowed out. Emerging slowly from the center of the cloud came Alice Cooper. He was carrying a pair of scissors, which he kept opening and snapping shut in his hands. He walked up to me and said, "I'm Alice." And all I could say was, "Fuck yes you are." With an entrance like that, he really was God. It wasn't until years later that I figured out what that smoke really was. By the time my arm healed, our second album, Shout at the Devil, was finished, and we were ready to play live again. When we were living together, we had watched Mad Max and Escape from New York nonstop until every image was engraved in our brains. We were starting to get bored with the glam punk image because so many other bands had copied it, so our look evolved into a cross between those two movies. The metamorphosis began one night at a show at the Santa Monica Civic Center. Joe Perry of Aerosmith was smashed out of his mind, and I walked over to him, took a grease pencil, and smeared it under my eyes, Road Warrior style. Joe said that it looked cool, and that was enough encouragement for me. From there, I put on a single-studded shoulder pad and war paint under my eyes, like one of the gas pirates in the Road Warrior. Then I had someone make me thigh-high leather boots with cages in the heels, which ejected smoke when I pressed a button. We painted a city skyline based on Escape from New York as a backdrop to our shows, shaped our amps like spikes, and built a drum riser to look like rubble from an exploded freeway. We thought we were the baddest creatures on God's great earth. Nobody could do it as hard as us and as much as us and get away with it like us. There was no competition. The more fucked up we got, the greater people thought we were, and the more they supplied us with what we needed to get even more fucked up. Radio stations brought us groupies. Management gave us drugs. Everyone we met made sure we were constantly fucked and fucked up. We thought nothing about whipping out our dicks and urinating on the floor of a radio station during an interview, or fucking the host on air if she was halfway decent looking. We thought we had elevated animal behavior to an art form. But then we met Ozzy. We weren't that excited when Elektra Records told us they'd gotten us the opening slot on Ozzy Osbourne's Bark at the Moon tour. We had played a few dates with Kiss after Too Fast for Love, and not only were they excruciatingly boring, but Gene Simmons had kicked us off the tour for bad behavior. Imagine my surprise 17 years later when ace businessman Gene Simmons called as I wrote this very chapter, asking not only for the film rights to The Dirt, but also for exclusive film rights to the story of Motley Crue for all eternity. We started warming up for the Ozzy tour at Longview Farm in Massachusetts, where the Rolling Stones rehearsed. We lived in lofts, and I begged them for the one where Keith Richards slept, which was in the barn. Our limousine drivers would bring us so many drugs and hookers from the city that we could barely keep our eyes open during rehearsals. Tommy and I kept a bucket positioned midway between us so that we'd have something to throw up into. One afternoon, our management and the record company came down to see our progress, or lack thereof, and I kept nodding out. Mick, our merciless overseer of quality control, bent into the microphone and announced to the assembled mass of business people and dispensers of checks, per diems, and advances, "Perhaps we could play these songs for you if Nikki hadn't been up all night doing heroin." I got so pissed off that I threw my bass to the ground, walked over to his microphone, and snapped the stand in half. Mick was already at the door by then, but I chased him down the country lane, both of us in high heels, like two hookers in a catfight. The tour began in Portland, Maine, and we walked into the arena to find Ozzy running through soundcheck. He wore a huge jacket made of fox fur and was adorned with pounds of gold jewelry. He was standing on stage with Jake E. Lee on guitar, Rudy Sarzo on bass, and Carmine Appice on drums. This wasn't going to be another Kiss tour. Ozzy was a trembling, twitching mass of nerves and crazy, incomprehensible energy who told us that when he was in Black Sabbath, he took acid every day for an entire year to see what would happen. There was nothing Ozzy hadn't done, and as a result, there was nothing Ozzy could remember having done. We hit it off with him from day one. He took us under his wing and made us comfortable facing 20,000 people every night, an ego boost like no other we've ever had. After the first show, a feeling came over me like the one I had when we sold out our first night at the Whiskey. Only this was bigger, better, and much closer to the victory line, wherever and whatever that was. The little dream that we had together in the Motley House was about to become a reality. Our days of killing cockroaches and humping for food were over. If the performance at the US Festival was a spark illuminating what we could become, then the Ozzy tour was the match that set the whole band ablaze. Without it, we probably would have been one of those LA bands like London, surefire stars who never quite fired. Ozzy hardly spent a night on his tour bus. He was always on ours. He'd burst through the door with a baggie full of coke singing, "I am the Krelly man, doing all the Krell that I can. And we'd snort up the Krell all night long until the bus stopped and we were in the next city. In one case, that city happened to be Lakeland, Florida. We rolled out of the bus under the heat of the noonday sun and went straight to the bar, which was separated from the swimming pool deck by a glass window. Ozzy pulled off his pants and stuck a dollar bill in his ass crack, then walked into the bar offering the dollar to each couple inside. When an elderly lady began to cuss him out, Ozzy grabbed her bag and took off running. He came back to the pool wearing nothing but a little day dress he had found in the bag. We were cracking up, though we weren't sure whether his antics were evidence of a wicked sense of humor or a severe case of schizophrenia. More and more, I tend to believe the latter. We were hanging out, us in t-shirts and leather, Ozzy in the dress, when all of a sudden Ozzy nudged me. "Hey, mate, I fancy a bump." "Dude," I told him, "we're out of blow. Maybe I can send the bus driver out for some." "Give me the straw," he said, unfazed. "But dude, there's no blow." "Give me the straw. I'm having a bump." I handed him the straw, and he walked over to a crack in the sidewalk and bent over it. I saw a long column of ants marching to a little sand dugout built where the pavement met the dirt. And as I thought, no, he wouldn't, he did. He put the straw to his nose, and with his bare white ass peeking out from under the dress like a sliced honeydew, sent the entire line of ants tickling up his nose with a single monstrous snort. He stood up, reared back his head, and concluded with a powerful right-nostriled sniff that probably sent a stray ant or two dripping down his throat. Then he hiked up the sundress, grabbed his dick, and pissed on the pavement. Without even looking at his growing audience, everyone on the tour was watching him, while the old women and families on the pool deck were pretending not to, he knelt down and, getting the dress soggy in the puddle, lapped it up. He didn't just flick it with his tongue. He took a half dozen long, lingering, and thorough strokes, like a cat. Then he stood up and, eyes blazing and mouth wet with urine, looked straight at me. "Do that, Six?" I swallowed and sweated. But this was peer pressure that I could not refuse. After all, he had done so much for Motley Crue. And if we wanted to maintain our reputation as rock's most cretinous band, I couldn't back down, not with everyone watching. I unzipped my pants and whipped out my dick in full view of everybody in the bar and around the pool. I don't give a fuck, I thought, to steady myself as I made my puddle. I'll lick up my piss, who cares? It comes from my body anyway. But as I bent down to finish what I had begun, Ozzy swooped in and beat me to it. There he was, on all fours at my feet, licking up my pee. I threw up my hands. You win, I said. And he did. From that moment on, we always knew that wherever we were, whatever we were doing, there was someone who was sicker and more disgusting than we were. But, unlike us, Ozzy had a restraint, a limit, a conscience, a break. And that restraint came in the form of a homely, rotund little British woman whose very name set lips trembling and knees knocking. Sharon Osbourne, a shit-kicker and disciplinarian like no other we had ever met. A woman whose presence could, in an instant, send us reeling back to our childhood fear of authority. After Florida, Sharon joined the tour to restore order. Suddenly, Ozzy turned into a perfect husband. He ate his vegetables, held her hand, and went to bed promptly after each show with neither drugs in his nose nor urine in his mouth. But it wasn't enough for Ozzy to behave. Sharon wanted us to behave. When she walked into our dressing room to find a girl on her hands and knees and the four of us standing there with our pants around our ankles and guilty little boy grins on our faces, she laid down the law. She wouldn't let us do drugs, invite girls backstage, or have fun in any way that didn't involve a board game. To make sure her rules were followed, she eliminated alcohol from our tour rider and appointed herself as sole keeper and distributor of backstage passes. We grew so frustrated that we had the merchandising company traveling with us make a new T-shirt. The front consisted of a smiley face riddled with bloody bullet holes. The back was a circle with a vertical column containing the words sex, fun, booze, parties, hot rods, pussy, heroin, motorcycles. A big red line was drawn through the circle, and below it were the words No Fun Tour, 83-84. We gave a shirt to everybody on the tour, including Ozzy. Eventually, I was reduced to crawling up to Sharon on my hands and knees and pleading, I really have to get laid. I'm going crazy. No, you can't, Nikki, she said firmly. You're going to get a disease. I don't care about diseases, I cried. I'll get a shot. I just want to get laid. Okay, she relented. Just this once. Thanks, Mom. She led me by the hand to the side of the stage and said, So, which one do you want? As if I were a little kid picking out sweets. I'll take the one in red, please. That same night, Carmine Appice left the tour. He had played with Vanilla Fudge, Cactus, and Rod Stewart, and was somewhat a star in his own right, so he thought he should be selling his own T-shirts. With uncharacteristic magnanimity, Sharon granted him permission. But when fans brought T-shirts back for Carmine to sign, all of them had a big hole over the breast. Sharon and Ozzy had cut Carmine's face out of all of his T-shirts. They got in a big fight, which concluded with Carmine quitting and Tommy Aldridge returning to the band to replace him on drums. Whenever Sharon left the tour, Ozzy returned to complete decadence. In Nashville, he shit in Tommy's bathroom and wiped it all over the walls. In Memphis, he and Vince stole a car with the key still dangling from the ignition, terrorized pedestrians on Beale Street, and then destroyed it, smashing the windows and gutting the upholstery. Days later, we happened to arrive in New Orleans on the second night of Mardi Gras. The town was on fire. Tommy, Jakey, and I got into a knife fight at a bar on Bourbon Street while Vince and Ozzy toured the strip clubs. When we all returned to the hotel, drunk and covered with blood, Mom was waiting for us. Sharon had flown into town, and she forbade us to hang out with Ozzy again. Sometimes, when Sharon was gone, Ozzy would break down like a child lost without his mother. In Italy, he bought a blow-up doll, drew a Hitler mustache on it, and kept it in the back room of our bus. On the way to Milan, he kept talking to it like it was his only friend. He told the doll that there was some kind of conspiracy, and everyone had turned against him and was plotting to kill him. When he went on stage that night, he was wearing Gestapo boots, panties, a bra, and a blonde wig. He seemed to be having a great time at first, but after a few songs, he snapped and started crying. I'm not an animal, he sobbed into the microphone. I'm not a freak. Then he apologized to the audience and walked off stage. That night in the hotel room Mick and I shared, he asked if he could use the phone. He picked it up and said, England, please. I grabbed the receiver out of his hands and hung it up. Dude, you can't call England. I don't have that kind of money. So we called collect. Sharon accepted. I'm just calling to tell you that I want a divorce, Ozzy said, as soberly and seriously as he could. Shut up and go to bed, she snapped back, then hung up on him. For some reason, our tour manager had the bright idea of putting obnoxious me and quiet Mick Mars in a room together. We were like the odd couple. I'd get frustrated writing a song and take my guitar into the hallway where I'd smash every single light. Then I'd come back into the room, trailing my broken axe behind me and asking Mick, say, can I borrow your guitar? We regularly came to blows, usually because I was partying or bringing girls to the room. After I pulled a clump of his hair out when he wouldn't let me borrow his guitar, I was finally given my own room. It didn't help Mick find any peace and quiet, though, because not long afterward, a hotel guest called the police after she saw Tommy streaking down the hall and the cops accidentally arrested Mick instead. We toured with Ozzy on and off for over a year, taking time off to play solo shows or gig with Saxon. In the meantime, we received our first gold and platinum record awards, heard ourselves on the radio for the first time, and started getting recognized in the streets outside Los Angeles. It was all happening quickly, and as a result, all of our relationships began to break down. The day the tour ended, the bus dropped me off in front of the house where Lita and I lived. I stood outside for 10 minutes with my suitcase in my hand, unsure whether to walk in or not. When I did, I hugged her and didn't say a word. I just stood there. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do. Something had turned off inside of me during the tour, and I had no idea how to turn it back on. When Lita left a few days later for her own tour, I was relieved. I was in no shape to carry on a relationship with her, especially with both of us constantly traveling, and I had no idea how to interact with a woman I respected anymore. By the time she returned, I had already arranged to move across the street and live with Robin Crosby. The day I moved in with him, life returned to complete destitution and depravity. He had just one bed and was kind enough to let me sleep in it while he crashed on the floor. Instead of a refrigerator, he had a styrofoam chest filled with bags of ice. It had a hole in the bottom, and the water constantly leaked all over the kitchen floor. The manager of the building hated me and warned every day that if he caught me throwing loud parties or drinking alcohol by the pool or misbehaving in any way, he'd throw me out on my tattooed ass. Though I couldn't afford a new styrofoam ice chest or a real refrigerator for the house, I had no problem buying a brand new Corvette. The day I drove it off the lot, I went to the Reseda Country Club and picked up a girl. We walked out to the parking lot, and I placed her on the hood, spread her legs in the air, and started fucking her. Slowly, a crowd gathered, and the only thing I remember them saying was, "Yeah, dude, nice car." To forget about Lita, I buried myself between the legs of other women. A small college girl who was attractive in a nerdy, bespectacled way moved into the other side of the building complex a few weeks after I started living there with Robin. So one night, instead of going out with Robin, I stopped by her house with a bottle of champagne, a bindle of cocaine, and a bunch of Quaaludes. We partied all night and, as planned, ended up fucking. When I walked back to my apartment at 7 in the morning, the manager was outside watering the flowers. Trying to suck up, I waved and smiled at him, as innocent as could be. He turned, looked at me, and dropped the hose. He just froze. I couldn't figure out what his problem was. I walked into the apartment and accidentally stepped on Robin. "Dude, what happened to you?" he exclaimed once his eyes adjusted to the light. "I was fucking that nerd chick. What's the big deal?" I asked. "No, dude, go look in the mirror," he said. I went over to the mirror, which was a giant broken pane someone had probably smashed out of a building lobby one drunken night, and looked at myself. My whole face was covered in blood, from my chin to my nose. Evidently, she had been having her period when I went down on her, and I was too fucked up to even notice. By the look of it, it must have been her first day. After a few weeks of fucking everything I could, I heard that a little punk rocker had introduced Lita to her new boyfriend, some guy named Don from a band called Heaven. Sure, I didn't want her anymore, but that didn't mean someone else was allowed to have her. Raging with illogical and hypocritical jealousy, I called Tommy. We met at my house, each grabbed a 2x4 plank, and walked over to Lita's house to assess the situation. We unlocked the door and stood in the middle of the room with our weapons. The only person home was the little punk rocker, who cowered in the corner as we rushed him, beating him mercilessly over the head and chest until finally breaking the boards over his back. We left him in the corner, with blood streaked all over the walls. A few hours later, the phone rang at my new place. "Fuck you!" It was Lita. "You are such a fucking asshole!" I explained my side of the story, and then she cut me down with a few well-chosen words that still ring in my head to this day. "That punk you just beat up didn't even introduce me to Don." I felt especially bad that I had involved Tommy, because the night before I had fucked his girlfriend, Honey. She had called to tell me she had drugs. I went over to partake, and one thing led to another, which led to me naked in the bathroom looking for some kind of ointment to put on the scratch marks on my back. It was yet another image to keep out of my mind at their engagement party. He was my best friend, and probably would have understood, but I've never been able to bring myself to tell him about it.
Chapter 5. Tommy. A showgirl from the Southeast learns that a jealous mind leads to exorbitant dental bills. Somebody told me there would be hot actress-type chicks kicking it at this party in Hollywood, so you know I was there. That's how I met Honey. The first thing I noticed, the first thing I always notice, was that she had huge tits. She had an amazing body, with the curves of a lingerie model, which, of course, she was. And she had a pretty face, but it wasn't exactly soft or delicate. It was covered not with physical scars, but more subtle emotional ones. I went into the bathroom with her to do some coke, and the next thing I knew, I was leaving her bathroom the next morning. That should have been the end of it. But dude, I always fuck up. I'm too open, too easily led, too ready to fucking fall in love all the time. I obsessed on Bullwinkle because she could come like a racehorse, and I flipped for Honey because she was a lingerie model, and I was so flattered a real model would even talk to me. But I never took a step back to look at them as they really were. Fucking crazy, dude. Like Bullwinkle, Honey was violently jealous. One night at the Troubadour, a girl walked behind me and pinched my ass. Without even stopping to ask questions, Honey wheeled around and put her cigarette out in the girl's fucking eye. Then Honey took her outside, twisted her arm behind her back, and fucking broke it. "Let's see you pinch him now," she spit as she walked away. I saw the girl with the rainbow in a cast 2 weeks later. She was too scared to even say hello. So, what did I do after that, dude? I fucking moved in with Honey. We found a condo on Gower Street in Hollywood. The day I came home carrying my first gold and platinum records for Shout at the Devil, she got jealous over a photograph of some girl she had found and threw a plate at me, which hit the case the gold award was in and shattered it. I never got jealous like she did. At one of RTB's parties, we were all sitting around the jacuzzi. She gave me a blowjob, and I told her to suck RTB's dick. I thought that was good business sense, to do a favor for the producer. Of course, I was too fucked up to remember that he had no interest in shit like that. He never seemed to partake in the girls or drugs at his parties. The only time I got pissed off was during the Aussie tour. We were in Buffalo, and I was stoked because I had seen snow for the first time in my life. Backstage, a fan came up to me and said, "Hey dude, your wife has a great-looking gash. You're a lucky man." I was wasted and had just come off stage, so I grabbed him and said, "What did you say?" "I said that your wife has got a fine pussy." I didn't know what the fuck he was talking about, but it sounded like a flat-out insult. So I swung and punched him in the fucking side of his head. He hit the ground unconscious. It was a good, solid hit, and I was proud of it. We waited on the tour bus while our manager, Doug Thaler, talked to the kid and tried to convince him not to press charges. "What was that all about?" I asked Doug when he climbed onto the bus. It turned out that Honey had sold photos of us fucking to a magazine called Celebrity Sex and hadn't told me about it. We pulled over at the nearest 7-Eleven and grabbed the issue. It was full of head-on action shots I had taken one night, and the headline was something like, "Tommy Lee's gal pal tells and shows all." I could have killed that bitch for trading off my newfound fame behind my back. But what did I do instead? After the Aussie shows, the tour bus dropped me off outside our condo. I walked to the door, swigging off a bottle of Jack I'd been drinking since the night before. Honey was waiting in the kitchen in a cleavage-bursting black dress. I was ready to cuss her out, but she interrupted me.
"Guess what?" she asked.
"What?"
"I found a minister. I bought some rings. I got everything set."
"For what?"
"I want to get married."
"To me?" "But you just fucking sold our pictures to a porn mag and didn't even tell me."
"It was going to be a birthday present for you, and I needed the money to buy the rings for our wedding, so I couldn't tell you."
I tried to think for a moment, but the alcohol wouldn't let me. Out of my mouth came the stupidest words I've ever spoken. "All right, fuck it. Let's do it." My parents were horrified. They offered me 100 good reasons not to get married. I was too young, her jealousy would only get worse. They didn't want a woman who would sell our intimate photos to a porn mag as a daughter-in-law. I refused to listen to them, but fortunately, circumstances soon intervened. The real problems began when we were home fighting because a girl was calling the house and hanging up. I didn't even know who it was, but honey kept insisting I was cheating on her. After an hour of shouting, she calmed down and agreed that maybe the girl was just some random freak. So I went to the kitchen to make a peanut butter sandwich. All of a sudden, she ran into the room, pulled open the silverware drawer, grabbed a butter knife, and plunged it into my back. The bitch was so fucking whacked that it actually penetrated the skin and slid in right next to my shoulder blade. I had to drive myself to the emergency room with a knife sticking out of my back. We were always either fucking like porn stars or fighting like wrestlers. One night, we went with RTB to one of the first WrestleMania matches, and she started picking a fight with me because she'd found a girl's phone number in my pants pocket, and on top of that, my mother had talked to her on the phone and accidentally called her Jessica, which was Bullwinkle's name. I had never been to a wrestling match before, but she wouldn't fucking shut up and let me enjoy it. After the match, Vince, Beth, RTB, Tom Zutaut, Honey, and I piled into RTB's limo and headed for the Tropicana to watch mud wrestling. Honey had been nagging the whole time and, because I was ignoring her, kept getting fiercer and fiercer to goad me into a response.
"Your mom's a fucking cunt anyway," she snarled. "I don't know why you even still talk to her."
"Please don't call my mom that," I sighed.
"Well, she is a cunt."
I have a long fuse, which gets somewhat shorter when I've been drinking. Honey had just about burned what was left of that fuse to the bottom, and I could feel my body preparing to explode. The trick to dealing with women like Honey is not to let them provoke you, because then they've won. I always seem to end up letting them win. "Listen, you bitch," I glared at her. "I'm not going to tell you again. Don't call my mom a cunt."
"She's a cunt, 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 cunt," Honey yelled.
"That's it," I turned to the driver. "Pull the car over. This fucking bitch is out of here." The driver pulled up to the curb, and I ordered Honey out. She refused and started punching me, so I grabbed her and dragged her onto the sidewalk. Then I reached back into the car, grabbed her purse, and threw it against the wall of the building behind her, splattering whatever shit was inside all over the ground. She ran at me, screaming.
"Your mom is a fucking cunt, and you know it. That's why you're such a spoiled little brat who loves his mother's cunt so much. Cunt, cunt, cunt."
I drew my arm back and, before I could even think about what I was doing, squeezed my hand into a fist and fucking smashed her right in the grill, dude. Her hands flew to her mouth and she dropped to the ground. I stood there shocked that I had actually lost all restraint. I'd never even dreamed of hitting a chick before. Then I jumped in the limo and slammed the door shut. As we drove away, I looked back and saw her kneeling on the pavement and spitting teeth into her hand, which was dripping with mucousy strands of blood. "She would have driven any of us to do that," Tom Zutaut said, reassuringly. "But someone's got to help her find her teeth." He stopped the limo and jumped out to console her and pick up teeth. The engagement was officially off.
Chapter 6 Nikki. Tender reminiscences of travels with Van Halen, AC/DC, Iron Maiden, and other gentle wayfarers of outlandish repute. When we left the Aussie tour to do some shows on our own, bringing along Rat for extra entertainment, the world, our world, wasn't the same anymore. I heard Shout at the Devil, Too Young to Fall in Love, and Looks That Kill everywhere. There was hysteria whenever we showed up at record stores to sign albums. And when we performed in towns we'd never even been to before, thousands of kids would show up. We were in a new world, one I'd always wanted to be in since I saw that first rock concert in a gymnasium in Jerome. But I was just an Idaho kid. I didn't know what to do in this new world or how to act. So I improvised. After a concert at the Bronco Bowl in Dallas, Texas, a blonde and a brunette in spandex and tube tops stumbled backstage before the show and said they wanted to do the whole band. It was either Vince or I who came up with the great idea of telling them they'd have to work for it. We grabbed a champagne bottle off the hospitality table and told the brunette that if she wanted to fuck us, she'd have to take the bottle and sit on it in the middle of the room. If you're not still sitting on that bottle when we come back, then you can't fuck the band, Vince said as we went on stage to play. After the show, she was still there, squatting in the middle of the room. Vince ducked into the production office to get a blowjob from two other girls simultaneously. Then we brought the two spandex girls out to the van. Vince and Tommy took the front seat and Mick and I sat in the back. The girls climbed into the front seat with Vince and Tommy and peeled off their clothes, which took a good 5 minutes because they were so tight. By the time they were off, Vince and Tommy were already fucking them doggy style. The girls were bent over the top of the seat, so the blonde grabbed at my pants as she was being fucked while the brunette did the same to Mick. They fumbled, unsnapped, and unzipped until they were blowing both of us. When we pulled into the hotel, we told the girls they had to remain naked. We took the elevator to Vince and Tommy's room and started drinking and getting stupid. The blonde was sitting with her legs spread open on the bed, and that gave us ideas. Tommy came back from the bathroom with a tube of toothpaste, so we stuffed it up her cap first. Then we figured it just wasn't fair to leave her with toothpaste, but no toothbrush. "What else do we have?" Tommy asked. "How about the fucking phone?" someone, probably me, suggested. We took the receiver off the hook and worked it inside until just the mouthpiece was hanging out. The girl sat there laughing the whole time, moaning occasionally, either because she was aroused or because she wanted us to think she was. "I'm hungry," Mick, who was watching bored from an armchair, grumbled. We told him to fuck off, then realized that maybe a compromise was possible. I dialed room service, and suddenly, through the blonde's open legs, we heard a muffled voice. "Hello, room service?" I bent over and recited our order into the girl's crotch. "What room?" "Room 227, I answered. The brunette started laughing. Suddenly, Vince, in a flash of inspiration, turned to her. "What do you think you're laughing at?" She stopped and stared at him blankly. "Does your mother know where you are?" Vince asked. "No," the girl said. "Don't you think she's worried about you?" "Maybe, I don't know. Perhaps you should call her." Suddenly it dawned on us what deviltry Vince was hatching. "What's her phone number?" She gave it to Vince, and he dialed it. Her mother answered, and the brunette bent over her friend's crotch. "Hi, Mom. I just called to say I'd be home soon. I'm at Sherry's right now, okay? Thanks." We didn't just lose respect for the girls that night. We lost respect for ourselves. When I returned to L.A., my half-sister Cece called and said that my mother had cracked and been committed to a mental institution in Seattle. I hadn't talked to my mother since I left her standing at the Greyhound terminal 6 years ago, and though I was still so angry and bitter, I felt like I needed to see her again, to connect with some element of my past before I lost it all. So I took a plane to Seattle, saddened by the fact that we were having our reunion in a mental hospital. When I walked in, I hardly recognized her. Those 6 years had not been good to her. Once, she'd had it all, looks, talent, and wit. But now she looked more like Ozzy than my mother. I ran up to her and stopped short of hugging her. She fixed me with her eyes, and the first thing out of her mouth was, "Did you write that song about me?" "What song?" I asked, confused. "Looks That Kill." I was floored. There were so many things I wanted to say to her, so many things I wanted her to say to me. But that wasn't one of them. I checked her out, put her in a cab, and brought her to my sister's house. We hardly spoke the whole time. We were both too proud and stubborn to explain or apologize for anything. As we sat in my sister's living room, flashing each other dirty, malevolent looks while my sister stood nearby, disapproving of both of us, I remembered why I had left in the first place. I just didn't belong there. And so I stood up, left, and caught the next plane to Los Angeles, back to the relative sanity of my drug dealers. The following week, we left for England to play a handful of dates on the Monsters of Rock bill with Van Halen, AC/DC, Dio, and for one date, Y&T. The night we arrived in England, I was lying on my bed in a Novotel outside Nottingham when I heard a knocking sound on the bathroom window. I tried to tune it out, assuming that it was just my imagination, but it was persistent. Finally, I got up to look and discovered a leggy, beautiful blonde standing on the ledge outside. I opened the window, and she looked me up and down. "Mind if I come in?" she asked, casual and polite, as if she were the neighborhood vicar stopping by for afternoon tea. She very daintily stepped into the bathroom and asked, "Mind if I drop my knickers?" "No, go ahead," I answered, taken aback. Though I was trying to seem casual, I'd never been more excited. "This is fucking cool," I thought to myself. I'm in England, the home of all my favorite bands, the Sweet, Slade, Bowie, Queen, the Sex Pistols, and there's a chick coming in through the bathroom window, just like in the Beatles song. She took off her pants so that they were hanging loose around one leg. I sat down on the toilet and she straddled me. With one hand on the towel rack and the other grabbing my hair, she got off. She stood up, pulled up her pants, and bowed slightly. "Thank you very much," she said in her genteel accent. "It's been an honor." Then she climbed onto the windowsill, stepped out to the ledge, and was gone. I picked up the phone and called Mick, Tommy, and Vince to tell them what had just happened and how much I loved England. The next day was the kickoff of the Monsters of Rock mini-tour. While we were traveling in the States with Rat, we had gotten into the habit of biting each other. Tommy would grab Vince, or a security guard, and clamp his teeth down on an arm until he broke the skin. It was all affectionate, of course, but it hurt like hell if you weren't fucked up. I was so drunk and coked up that first show that I walked up to Eddie Van Halen and tackled him. Then I reared my head up, lifted his shirt, and sank my teeth into his bare stomach. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" his wife, Valerie Bertinelli, bellowed. "Biting my husband? You fucking freak!" Eddie stood up, dusted himself off, and narrowed his squinty eyes. I couldn't tell whether he was turned on or offended. Before I had a chance to apologize, Vince ran up to him like a savage dog and sank his teeth into his hand. And that threw Valerie into hysterics. Nobody bites the hand that Eddie Van Halen uses to play guitar with. I must have bitten Angus Young, too, because his brother Malcolm walked up to me in a rage. I was wearing platform boots, and Malcolm's face was eye level with my belly button. "You fucking bastard," he roared at my navel. "You can bite my brother, fine, but if you fucking bite me, I'll bite your fucking nose off, you dog-faced faggot." I think I said something like, "You and what stepladder?" Because before I knew it, he was attacking me, climbing up my leg and clawing at my face like a crazed cat. Doc McGee pulled him off and, holding him by the scruff of the neck, threw him outside the dressing room. We could hear him scratching at the door and hissing as Doug told us the news. "Congratulations," he said. "After this tour, you're opening for Iron Maiden." "Fucking cool. Now I don't have to go home," I said, thinking about my midnight visitor the night before. "By the way," Doc continued, "Bruce Dickinson would like to meet you." Bruce was Iron Maiden's new singer, and though his literary galloping heavy metal was never my favorite music, he was still a legend. Doc walked out the door and, holding Malcolm at bay with his right hand, signaled to Bruce and a woman who was with him. They walked into the dressing room. My heart dropped into my hands and my testicles shrank to the size of Malcolm's little fists. I tried to stammer hello to them, but found myself tongue-tied. There she was, the girl who had crawled in my window the night before. And I didn't know if she was Bruce Dickinson's wife, girlfriend, manager, personal assistant, or what. It was on the Monsters of Rock and Iron Maiden tours that the tedium began. In Hollywood, gigging was a way of life. But gigging was not the same as touring. When you gig, you get to go home afterward. Touring is an endless parade of anonymity. Faceless people, identical hotel rooms, and indistinguishable cities, always changing but always the same. In America, at least we had the consolation of watching our star rise as we toured. But in Europe, nothing seemed real or relevant. On past tours, I would sit in my hotel room and write postcards to my grandparents in Jerome, Idaho, population 4,000, telling them how lonely I was and how much I missed having a home to go to. But after my reunion with my mother, I didn't want a home anymore. I became crazier and more reckless, subconsciously putting myself on the same self-destructive path my mother had been on. My rock and roll fantasy wasn't just about success and decadence and rebellion anymore. It was also about pain and death. I was sure I was going to die before I was 25. I think we all thought that. Tommy and I began breaking glass bottles over each other's head and twisting the light bulbs out of makeup mirrors and swallowing them whole, just for fun. When Vince was in a bathroom with some groupie or waitress, we'd sneak in, not because we wanted to double-team her, but because we wanted to sneak the drugs out of Vince's pants pocket while he was preoccupied. As singer, Vince had the hardest time recuperating from all the partying. He was usually so thrashed that the only way he could make it through most shows was if we called a doctor to shoot his ass full of cortisone before going on stage. At the Ritz in Paris, Vince was trying to get to the front desk for a phone call, but he was so fucked up he couldn't figure out how to open the glass door at the hotel entrance. So he kicked through it, shattering the glass and sending the brass door handle clattering to the ground. He picked the brass handle off the floor, handed it to the concierge, and took the call as if nothing had happened. In Germany, we got high with Claude Schnell, the keyboard player from Dio, in his hotel room. When he ran out of the room to get something, we decided to fuck with him. We picked up the two tiny European beds in the room and threw them, piece by piece, out the window, followed by his chairs, desk, television, and dresser. Two brand-new Mercedes-Benzes were parked below the room, and each piece of furniture managed to land on one. Suddenly, the German police were knocking on Claude's door with Rottweilers. His whole band had to pack up and leave the hotel, which banned Dio for years, while we stayed there guiltily. I may not like their Intermission album, but I'll always give Dio credit for not telling on us. In Switzerland, after the Iron Maiden tour, we weren't so lucky. Tommy and Vince bought flare guns and fired one in their room. A giant ball of fire shot out and ricocheted off the walls before setting Tommy's mattress on fire. He and Vince were so amused that they ran to find Doc to show him the flaming bed. But when they returned to the room with him, they discovered that they had locked their keys inside. By the time the maid let them in, smoke was billowing from under the door. For some reason, they didn't kick us out of the hotel until the following day when we used the giant balls of metal attached to the room keys to break all the glass windows in the elevators. We were really fucking bored of Europe. Adding an extra element of awkward tension to the Maiden tour was the fact that the mystery bathroom window girl hung around Bruce the whole time. Every time I saw Bruce, he would offer me fencing lessons because he was really into sword play. I kept turning him down, though, because I was sure he was going to use the fencing lesson as an excuse to accidentally stab me to death for fucking her. When Maiden's drummer, Nico McBain, was busted on the border between France and Germany for carrying hash, no one in the band bothered to warn us back at the venue, where we were always the last to leave because we were partying. I always thought that this was a purposeful act of revenge, because when we finally reached the border, customs officials and dogs swarmed onto the bus as we snorted and swallowed everything we could find. When they went through Tommy's bags, a giant lump of hash fell onto the ground. It sat there for minutes, looking like a dirt clod, as we sweated nervously. Then, the official searching Tommy's bag zipped it up, looked around the bus, and walked toward Vince. He stepped on the hash, and it stuck to the bottom of his shoe like a piece of gum. The officers then made me strip, put my arms against the wall, and bend over so that they could look up my ass. I tightened my sphincter muscle and tried as hard as I could to shit on their heads. I pushed and pushed and pushed, but couldn't get any results. After the border incident, we started planting bugs in Iron Maiden's dressing room to find out, first, if they were responsible for the intense search, and second, who the fuck that girl was. Except for Nico, none of them seemed to like us. On the last night of the tour, Bruce even walked up to Mick and challenged him to a duel. I think he thought that Mick had messed around with that girl. By the end of the European tour, we sounded terrible. Vince was getting so fucked up every night that no doctor or medication could make him sound good on stage. Our last show in Europe, at the Dominion Theater in London, was our worst. We looked ridiculous because our style was beginning to evolve from Road Warrior darkness to more colorful, theatrical one-piece court jester suits. For the show, I wore a dark green outfit, painted my base the same color, and put on matching moccasin shoes. I looked like an overgrown leprechaun. There must have been a butcher shop or something nearby because throughout the show, fans kept catapulting leg bones and animal heads and strange sausages at us. We took it as a compliment until Tommy's drum tech, Clyde Duncan, collapsed to the ground. We looked over, and he had a dart sticking out of his back. Tommy, with one hand, pulled the dart out while playing. Minutes after that, the dry ice machine blew up. A strong odor of what smelled like hot dog juice wafted across the stage and clung to my clothing, and a wet puddle formed around my feet. The road crew, I assumed, was pouring hot dog juice onto the stage as an end-of-tour joke. I thought it was a pretty lame prank, but when I looked back at Tommy, he seemed panic-stricken. His drum set was surrounded by water, and I assumed they had poured hot dog juice all over him, too. After Vince croaked through our last song, I splashed through the water on the stage to find Tommy. He was leaning over Clyde, and the smell of hot dogs was unbearable. I moved in closer and discovered that the smell was actually Clyde's burned skin. The dry ice machine had blown up in his face, frying his skin like a kosher red hot and sending water running down the stage, which sloped forward. Clyde was still in agony when we flew back to America afterward. Fortunately, we had a lot of painkillers. At the time, we didn't think of drugs as addictive. They were just something that we liked to do all the time to keep ourselves from getting bored. We weren't addicted. We were just constant users. As we flew home, I thought about another plane ride. A few months before, after we had received our platinum awards in Manhattan for Shout at the Devil, I flew to Nantucket to meet some girls. I had met Demi Moore at the award parties, and she was waiting to greet me as the prop plane arrived. She was working on a movie there with Bobcat Goldthwait, who was also on the runway along with a handful of other actors and crew members. My head was spinning because I had gotten so drunk and high on the flight. I walked out of the plane to the top of the staircase leading to the tarmac. I had the awards cradled in my left hand, a bottle of Jack in my right hand, and an ounce of cocaine crushed flat in my back pocket. I imagine them looking at me. I looked like a real rock star, like Johnny Thunders. As I stepped down from the doorway, my shoe slid off the edge of the top step and I lost my balance. I tried to catch myself on the railing, but only succeeded in dropping the bottle of Jack, which smashed on the steps below. I followed it, tumbling head first, a mess of broken glass, alcohol, and limbs. I hit the runway first, followed by the award plaques, which knocked me in the head. I opened my eyes to find Demi, Bobcat, and their friends standing over me, helping me to my feet and looking at me very disapprovingly. They had been where I was. That day was the first time I heard of AA. When Demi and Bobcat suggested that I look into the program, I shrugged them off. But I could see it in their eyes and the way they shook their heads and looked at each other. They knew that very soon I would be one of them. I was partying without any thought for consequences because to me, consequences didn't exist. We were Motley Crue. We had a platinum record and we were bigger than the New York Dolls ever were. We were young, fucked up, and worshipped for it. Words like consequences, responsibility, morality, and self-control didn't apply to us. Or so we thought.
Part 5. Save Our Souls. Chapter 1. Mick. A man of disconsolate heart is led by trickery, intoxication, and self-deceit toward a watery grave. Have you ever had anyone call the police or security or your landlord on you for playing your music too loud? How can such a beautiful thing be pissed on so much? If you're at home playing a good album and some nosy-ass neighbor claims he can't hear his TV, why does your music have to suffer so he can watch his TV? I say, too bad for the neighbor. Music is censored as it is. You can't say shit or piss or fuck or cock-a-doodle dipshit on your records if you want them on the radio and in Walmart. It's not allowed. And if you want your video on TV, you can't wear certain clothes and you can't have images of guns or body bags. Is music that dangerous? More dangerous than the death, murder, suicide, and rape I see on TV and in the movies all the time? Yet write a little old love song about the same topics and no one will play it on the radio. And you can't crank it on your home stereo because then it's too fucking loud for your neighbors. It's pretty powerful stuff, that music. But I wouldn't have it any other way. People suck. Music doesn't. When I was home in Manhattan Beach with The Thing, all I wanted to do was play my stereo or bang on my guitar. But I'd get shut down because of dumbass neighbors trying to watch murder and teenage sex on television. However, they never seemed to complain or interfere when The Thing was bitching me out and beating the shit out of me. That was okay. Maybe they thought I deserved it for playing my music too loud. I was taught as a kid never to hit a lady, even if she hits you first. So when The Thing had her tantrums, I never slugged her back. In fact, I moved in with her. I felt so old that I didn't think it would be possible for me to get another decent-looking woman. I've never really understood women anyway. On the Monsters of Rock tour in Sweden, one of the guys from AC/DC brought a girl back to the hotel bar. He was really drunk and puked all over her. A hotel security guard brought him up to his room, but he was back in 15 minutes pounding on the bar for more beer. After drinking enough to make himself sick again, he asked the girl to come up to his room with him. She was still stained with his puke, but she said yes anyway. How gross is that? That is worse than Ozzy snorting ants. What's wrong with these women? Vince and his wife Beth had moved into a house near The Thing and me in Manhattan Beach. The Thing was friends with Beth, and together, the two were the toughest broads you've ever seen. The Thing was the type that punched first and asked questions later, and Beth was more the nagging kind, very sensitive about cleanliness and paranoid about germs. I don't know how Vince got away with all the shit he did. He would go to the Tropicana, a strip club with a ring where women wrestled in baby oil, and he'd come home after 2 in the morning. When Beth would ask why he was covered with oil, Vince would just say, "Oh, I was at Benihana and the cook at the table got carried away." And that would be it. I never went to those places. No interest. What's the use of looking if you can't touch? After returning from the last Shout shows in England, Vince threw a party at his house to celebrate the start of our next album. A day or two into Vince's party, The Thing walked into our living room with her sleeves rolled up. I was sitting on the couch, fucked up as usual, and watching an episode of Nova about mathematical theories. I'd taken a couple of Quaaludes and was drinking Jack and Bellers. A Beller was something my friend Stick and I invented. It was a mix of Kahlua and brandy named after the way old ladies at the bar would beller at us. The Thing knocked me upside the head and demanded to be taken to Vince and Beth's. I didn't really want to leave the couch, but I figured going was easier than staying home all day and fighting. So we went to Vince's place and ended up in a fight anyway. It was so pointless. There was no way to win with her, and I was miserable and sick of being abused. It just wasn't worth the trouble, especially since her friends had been telling me that she was fucking some jock behind my back. I think she thought that he had more money than I did. I was so aggravated that I walked out of Vince's house and onto the beach. My head kept ringing, "Do yourself in, do yourself in." I didn't really want to end it all. I'd been through worse. I just wanted peace and quiet. So I waded into the ocean with a beller in my hand. The waves were cold and kept smacking my clothes higher and higher until they knocked my drink out of my hand. Soon my hair was wet and sticking to the back of my neck. Then I blacked out.
Chapter 2. Tommy. Of a party that ends in misadventure when an ill-advised remedy is offered for a wellspring that has run dry. It was me, Mick, Vince, and the guys from Hanoi Rocks who were in town partying. We were doing a shitload of drinking at Vince's and just having a killer time. We'd probably been barbecuing, boozing, and occasionally sleeping for a good 3 or 4 days when we finally ran out of beer. Vince wanted to show off his new Pantera, so he asked who wanted to make a beer run. Razzle volunteered first, and the two of them disappeared out the door. The liquor store was only a few blocks away, but they were gone for a long-ass time. Mick had disappeared too, and no one knew where he had gone. But that was typical behavior for that sneaky fucker. And Nicky hadn't even shown up to the party, so no one knew where the fuck he was either. "Dude," I said to a collective couch of wives, "even if Vince took Razzle on a fucking joyride, they should be back by now. The liquor store is only around the corner, so what the fuck are they doing?" That's when we began to worry that maybe they'd crashed or been jacked for cash. I had no clue. Then we heard ambulances careen past the house, whip around the corner, and squeal to a halt. I sobered up on the spot. I think everyone did, because there was no doubt who those ambulances were for. We ran out of the house. The road curved around to the left, making it impossible to see what was around the corner. We walked and walked and walked, it seemed like forever, watching the red flashing lights bounce off nearby buildings. When we turned the corner, there were fire trucks, ambulances, police cars, and dozens of people in shorts standing on the corner just gawking. I turned my head to see what they were gawking at, and the first thing I saw was that red fucking Pantera. It was smashed. Not head-on, but at a slight angle, into another car, and its passenger side had collapsed on itself like an accordion. The road was littered with shit, glass, metal, plastic, and in the middle of it all, a fucking Chuck Taylor high top. It was the shoe that Razzle always wore. In my mind, though, I just couldn't make sense of anything. Why was Razzle's high top in the middle of the street? Where was Vince? What was going on? What should I be doing, saying, thinking, screaming? Then I saw him. Vince. He was sitting on the curb, his arms wrapped around his ankles, rocking back and forth. I ran toward him, and as I did, I saw Razzle out of the corner of my eye. He was being carried on a stretcher toward the open back doors of an ambulance. I figured that he was all right, though obviously in need of some serious attention, considering the state of his side of the Pantera. Vince was covered with blood. And just rocking, and making this strange sound that seemed to come from such a painful place that I don't think I can even call it crying. I don't know if he was in pain.